Sometimes he's impossible.
She fished in her purse and came out with the camera belonging to Roy's mother. He dropped this off at the house late last night, after Lana and Dad went to bed. He says he got the pictures you wanted. I tried to take a look, but I couldn't figure out how to work the darn thing. Wordlessly, Roy grabbed the camera and stashed it in his locker.
Keep your fingers crossed, Beatrice said, before melting into the stream of students and disappearing down the hall.
Roy spent the rest of the morning lost in excited distraction, wondering if his plan might actually work. At 10:45 a.m., a black stretch limousine pulled up to the empty lot at Woodbury and East Oriole. The driver got out and opened one of the doors. Nothing happened for several moments, and then a tall man with wavy silver hair emerged, squinting into the sun. He wore pressed white trousers and a dark blue blazer with an emblem on the breast pocket. The man glanced around impatiently behind enormous tinted glasses. Crisply, he snapped his fingers at Officer David Delinko, who was unlocking his squad car. The patrolman failed to notice he was being summoned. He was knocking off work after 14 straight hours at the construction site. Curly had gone home to shower and shave, so Officer Delinko had stayed to keep an eye on the earth-moving machines, which had been refitted with new seats. Now that the foreman had returned, dressed up in a coat and tie of all things, the policeman was leaving the premises. He had no desire to hang around for the groundbreaking nonsense.
"Officer!" the silver-haired man beckoned insistently. "Yo, officer! Over here!"
Officer Delinko approached the limousine and asked what was wrong. The man introduced himself as Chuck E. Muckle, a vice president of something or other for Mother Paula's All-American Pancake Houses, Inc. In a confidential tone, he added, "We need some discreet assistance here."
"Well, I'm off duty," Officer Delinko told him, "but I'd be glad to call for another unit."
He was so exhausted from lack of sleep that he barely had enough energy to carry on a conversation.
"Do you happen to know who's sitting in this car?" Chuck Muckle asked, nodding toward the limo.
"No, sir."
"Miss Kimberly Lou Dixon."
"That's nice," said Officer Delinko blankly.
"The Kimberly Lou Dixon."
"Well, what do you know?"
Chuck Muckle thrust his ruddy face closer.
"You've got no idea who I'm talking about, do you, officer?"
"Not a clue, sir. Never heard of the lady."
The company vice president rolled his eyes and proceeded to explain who Kimberly Lou Dixon was and why she traveled all the way from Beverly Hills, California, to Coconut Cove, Florida.
"And right this minute," Chuck Muckle said, "she rather urgently needs a powder room."
"A powder room?"
Officer Delinko repeated quizzically.
"A place to powder her nose. A place to freshen up."
Chuck Muckle erupted in exasperation.
"Is this really such a difficult concept to grasp, officer? Let me try to put this in language you can understand. She needs a potty, okay?"
"Gotcha."
Officer Delinko gestured toward Curly's trailer. "Follow me." When Kimberly Lou Dixon got out of the limousine, Officer Delinko was startled by how young she looked compared with the wrinkled old granny she played on the TV commercials. Kimberly Lou had bright green eyes and rich auburn hair and smooth, milky skin. A lovely and cultured woman, Officer Delinko thought. Then she opened her mouth.
"I got a tinkle," she announced in a sandpaper voice. "Lead the way, hotshot."
The actress carried a leather tote bag over one shoulder, and she wore high heels, a black skirt, and a pale, silky blouse. Curly was dumbstruck when he opened the door of the trailer. Without a word, Kimberly Lou Dixon stepped past him and made her way to the bathroom.
"Can I change in here?"
she asked in a husky voice.
"Change what? You look pretty darn good the way you are."
"Change into Mother Paula's costume," Officer Delinko interjected. "She's with some guy. He wants to know if she can use your trailer as a dressing room."
"Anytime,"
Curly said with a dreamy smile. A man's silhouette filled the doorway, followed by a gust of oily cologne.
"Why, you must be the one and only Leroy Brannett," growled a familiar, sarcastic voice.
Curly cringed. Officer Delinko stepped out of the way and said, "This gentleman is from the Pancake House Company?"
"I figured," said Curly.
He held out his right hand to Chuck Muckle,
who stared at it as if it were a dead mudfish.
"Please tell me, Mr. Brannett, that you have no bad news that would spoil this lovely tropical morning. Tell me everything's hunky-dory here in Coconut Cove."
"Yes, sir," Curly said. "We stayed the last two nights on the property, me and the policeman here, and it's been peaceful as a church house. Ain't that right, David?"
"Righto," Officer Delenko said. Chuck Muckle whipped off his shades and eyed the patrolman dubiously.
"You wouldn't happen to be the same crackerjack lawman who fell asleep in his car while the vandal trashed our survey stakes, would you?"
As curious as Officer Delenko was to see Kimberly Lou Dixon dressed up as Mother Paula, he now wished that he were somewhere far, far away.
"The same genius," Mr. Muckle went on, "whose careless sleep habits resulted in a newspaper article that unfairly smeared the good name and reputation of Mother Paula? Was that you?"
"Yeah, that would be him," Curly said.
Officer Delenko shot the foreman a dirty look before addressing Mr. Muckle.
"I'm really sorry about all that, sir," the patrolman said, thinking, "sorrier for me than for you."
"It's rather astounding that you still have a job," Chuck Muckle remarked. "Your police chief must have a charitable heart. Either that or he's desperate for warm bodies." Curly finally came up with something positive to contribute.
"Officer Delenko's the one who helped me catch that burglar the other night."
It was a shameless exaggeration of Curly's role in the capture of Dana Matherson, and Officer Delenko was about to set the record straight when Kimberly Lou Dixon came rocketing out of the bathroom.
"You've got, like, a major roach situation in there," she exclaimed.
"They ain't roaches, they're crickets," Curly said. "I don't know where the heck they all came from."
He elbowed his way past Officer Delenko and Chuck Muckle and introduced himself to the actress.
"I'm the supervising engineer on this project, Miss Dixon, and I just want you to know that I've seen all your movies."
"All two of them, you mean?"
Kimberly Lou Dixon patted his shiny scalp.
"That's all right, Mr. Brannett. It's still a darling thing for you to say."
"Hey, I can't wait for your new one, too. Mutant Invaders from Saturn 11. I really go for that sci-fi stuff."
"Jupiter 7, Chuck Muckle cut in. "It's called Mutant Invaders from Jupiter 7.
"Whatever," Curly gushed. "You're gonna make a fantastic grasshopper queen."
"Yeah, I'm already writing my Oscar speech."
The actress glanced at her diamond-studded wristwatch.
"Listen, I better hurry up and start turning myself into adorable old Mother Paula. Can one of you sweethearts please fetch my suitcase out of the limo?"
20. A smaller limousine delivered the Coconut Cove mayor, Councilman Bruce Grandy, and the Chamber of Commerce president to the construction site. A satellite truck from a Naples television station came next, followed by a newspaper photographer. City workers tied red, white, and blue streamers to the fence and hung a hand-lettered banner that said, "Welcome, Mother Paula." At 10 minutes to noon, Roy and Beatrice arrived. This time she rode the handlebars and he pedaled, the camera stowed safely in his backpack. They were startled to see that they weren't the only ones to show up. The freckle-faced boy, the red-haired girl, and at least half of Mr. Ryan's history class were already there, along with a bunch of parents.
"What in the world did you say to those kids yesterday?" Beatrice asked. "You promised them free flapjacks or something?"
"I just talked about the owls, that's all," Roy said.
He got another pleasant surprise when a van from the Trace Middle School Athletic Department rolled up, and Beatrice's soccer teammates piled out, some of them carrying posters. Roy grinned at Beatrice, who shrugged as if it was no big deal. They scanned the growing crowd but saw no sign of her runaway stepbrother. There was no sign of the owls either, which didn't surprise Roy. With so much noise and human commotion, the birds would likely stay underground where it was dark and safe. Roy knew that's what the pancake people were betting on, that the owls would be too frightened to venture out. At 12:15, the door of the construction trailer swung open. First to emerge was a policeman, whom Roy recognized as Officer Delenko. Then the bald construction foreman with the rotten temper. Then a snooty-looking guy with silver hair and dorky sunglasses. The last to come out was the woman who played Mother Paula on the TV commercials. She wore a shiny gray wig, wire-rimmed glasses, and a calico apron.
A few people clapped in recognition, and she waved half-heartedly. The group marched to a rectangular clearing that had been roped off in the center of the construction site. A megaphone was handed to the silvery-haired guy, who said his name was Chuck E. Muckle, a vice president from Mother Paula's company headquarters. He really thought he was hot snot, Roy could tell. Ignoring the foreman and the police officer, Mr. Muckle proceeded with great enthusiasm to introduce some local big shots, the mayor, a city councilman, and the head of the Chamber of Commerce.
I can't tell you how proud and delighted we are to make Coconut Cove the home of our 469th family-style restaurant, Mr. Muckle said. Mr. Mayor, Councilman Grandy, all of you terrific folks who've come out on this gorgeous Florida day, I'm here to promise you that Mother Paula will be a good citizen, a good friend, and a good neighbor to everybody.
Unless you're an owl, Roy said. Mr. Muckle didn't hear it. Saluting the gathering of students, he said,
I am truly excited to see so many of our fine young people here today. This is a historic moment for your town. Our town, I should say. And we're happy you can take a short break from your classes and celebrate with us.
He paused and manufactured a chuckle.
Anyway, I expect we'll be seeing most of you again once the restaurant opens and Mother Paula's busy in the kitchen. Hey, everybody, who likes licorice oatmeal pancakes?
It was an awkward moment. Only the mayor and Councilman Grandy raised their hands. The girl soccer players held their homemade signs with the blank side facing out as they awaited directions from Beatrice. Mr. Muckle snickered nervously.
Mother Paula, dearest, I think it's time. Shall we do the deed?
They all posed side by side, the company VP, the mayor, Mother Paula, Councilman Grandy, and the boss of the Chamber of Commerce, for the television crew and the news photographer. Gold-painted shovels were handed out, and on Mr. Muckle's signal, all the dignitaries smiled, leaned over, and dug up a scoopful of sand. On cue, a smattering of city employees in the crowd cheered and applauded. It was the most bogus thing Roy had ever seen. He couldn't believe anyone would put it on TV or in the newspaper.
These people, Beatrice said, need a life.
As soon as the photo pose ended, Mr. Muckle tossed down his gold shovel and snatched up the megaphone.
Before the bulldozers and backhoes get rolling, he said, Mother Paula herself wants to say a few words.
Mother Paula didn't look overjoyed to have the megaphone shoved in her hand.
You've got a real nice town, she said. I'll see you next spring at the grand opening.
Oh, no, you won't.
This time the words came out of Roy's mouth as a shout, and nobody was more stunned than he. A tremor rippled through the audience, and Beatrice edged closer, half expecting somebody to come after him. The actress playing Mother Paula seemed miffed, peering over her cheap wire-rimmed glasses into the crowd.
Now who said that?
Roy found himself raising his right arm.
I did, Mother Paula, he called out. If you hurt a single one of our owls, I'm not eating any more of your stupid pancakes.
What are you talking about? What owls?
Chuck Muckle lunged for the megaphone, but Mother Paula threw an elbow and caught him squarely in the gut.
Back off, Chuck E. Cheeseball, she huffed.
Go on, check it out for yourself, Roy said, gesturing around. Wherever you see one of those holes, there's an owl den underneath. It's where they build their nests and lay their eggs. It's their home.
Mr. Muckle's cheeks turned purple. The mayor looked lost. Councilman Grandy looked like he was about to faint, and the Chamber of Commerce guy looked like he'd swallowed a bar of soap. By now, the parents in the crowd were talking loudly and pointing at the den holes. A few of the school kids started chanting in support of Roy, and Beatrice's soccer teammates began waving their hand-lettered signs. One said, Mother Paula doesn't give a hoot about owls. Another read, Bird killers go home. And still a third sign said, Save the owls! Bury the buttermilks! As the news photographer snapped pictures of the protesters, Mother Paula pleaded,
But I don't want to hurt owls. Really, I wouldn't hurt a flea.
Chuck Muckle finally recaptured the megaphone and boomed a harsh scolding at Roy.
Young fellow, you'd better get your facts straight before making such outrageous and slanderous charges.
There are no owls here, not one. Those old burrows have been abandoned for years.
Yeah?
Roy reached into his backpack and whipped out his mother's camera.
I've got proof, he shouted. Right here.
The kids in the crowd hooted and hurrahed. Chuck Muckle's face went gray and slack. He held out his arms and lurched toward Roy.
Let me see that.
Scooting out of reach, Roy switched on the digital camera and held his breath. He had no idea what he was about to see. He pressed the button to display the first photograph that Mullet Fingers had taken. The instant that the blurred, crooked image appeared in the viewfinder, Roy knew he was in trouble. It was the picture of a finger. Anxiously, he clicked to the second frame, and what he saw was no less discouraging. A dirty bare foot. It appeared to be a boy's foot, and Roy knew whose it was. Beatrice's stepbrother had many special talents, but nature photography obviously wasn't one of them. In desperation, Roy touched the button once more, and a third picture clicked into view. This time, there was definitely something other than a human body part visible on the frame. A distant, feathery form, unevenly illuminated by the camera's flash.
Here! Roy cried. Look!
Chuck Muckle snatched the camera from him and examined the photo for all of about 3 seconds before bursting into cruel laughter.
What's that supposed to be?
It's an owl,
Roy said. And it was an owl, Roy was certain. Unfortunately, the bird must have swiveled its head just as Mullet Finger snapped the picture.
Looks more like a lump of mud to me,
Chuck Muckle said. He raised the camera so that those in the very front of the audience could see the viewfinder.
Boy's got quite an imagination, doesn't he?
He added snidely.
That's an owl. Then I'm a bald eagle.
But it is an owl, Roy insisted. And that picture was taken right here on this property last night.
Prove it,
Chuck Muckle gloated. Roy had no response. He couldn't prove a thing. His mom's camera was passed around the fringes of the crowd, and by the time it got back to Roy, he knew that most people couldn't really tell it was a bird in the photograph. Even Beatrice wasn't sure, turning the viewfinder sideways and upside down as she tried in vain to identify a telltale part of owl anatomy. Roy was crushed. The pictures taken by her stepbrother were worthless. The authorities in charge of protecting the burrowing owls would never block construction of the pancake house based on such fuzzy evidence.
Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Muckle told the crowd through his megaphone. And thanks also for your patience during this rather inconsiderate delay. We'll see all you pancake lovers next spring for a big hearty breakfast. In the meantime, this event is now officially over.
The kids from Trace Middle stirred restlessly and looked toward Beatrice and Roy, who no longer had much of a plan. Roy could feel his shoulders sagging in defeat, while Beatrice's face had become a mask of grim resignation. Then a young voice rose up.
Wait, it ain't over. Not by a mile it ain't.
This time it wasn't Roy.
Uh-oh,
said Beatrice, lifting her eyes. A girl in the rear of the crowd let out a shriek, and everybody wheeled at once to look. At first glance, the object on the ground could have been mistaken for a kickball, but it was actually a boy's head. His matted hair was blonde, his face was caramel brown, and his eyes were wide and unblinking. A kite string led from his pursed lips to the handle of a large tin bucket a few feet away. The big shots came hurrying out of the crowd with Beatrice and Roy on their heels. They all stopped to gape at the head on the ground.
What now?
Moaned the construction foreman. Chuck Muckle thundered.
Is this somebody's idea of a sick joke?
Good heavens, cried the mayor. Is he dead?
The boy wasn't the least bit dead. He smiled up at his stepsister and winked slyly at Roy. Somehow he'd fit his entire skinny body down the opening of an owl burrow, so that only his noggin stuck out.
Yo, Mother Paula,
he said. The actress stepped forward hesitantly. Her wig looked slightly crooked, and her makeup was beginning to melt in the humidity.
What is it?
She asked uneasily.
You bury those birds, Mullet Fingers said. You gotta bury me, too. But no, I love birds. All birds.
Officer Delinko, where are you?
Chuck Muckle motioned for the policeman to come forward.
Arrest this impertinent little creep right now.
For what?
Trespassing, obviously.
But your company advertised this event as open to the public, Officer Delinco pointed out. If I arrest the boy, I'll have to arrest everybody else on the property, too.
Roy watched as a vein in Mr. Muckle's neck swelled up and began to pulse like a garden hose.
I'll be speaking to Chief Deacon about you first thing tomorrow,
Mr. Muckle hissed under his breath at the patrolman.
That gives you one whole night to work on your sorry excuse for a resume.
Next, he turned his withering gaze upon the forlorn foreman.
Mr. Brannett, please uproot this stringy weed.
Wouldn't try that,
Beatrice's stepbrother warned through clenched jaws.
Really? And why not?
Chuck Muckle said. The boy smiled.
Roy, do me a favor. Check out what's in the bucket.
Roy was happy to oblige.
What do you see?
The boy asked.
Cottonmouth moccasins, Roy replied.
How many?
9 or 10?
They look happy, Roy.
Not really.
What do you think's gonna happen if I tip that thing over?
With his tongue, Mullet Fingers displayed the string that connected him to the bucket.
Somebody could get hurt pretty bad, Roy said, playing along.
He had been mildly surprised, though relieved, to see that the reptiles in the bucket were made of rubber. Mr. Muckle stewed.
This is ridiculous. Brannett, do what I told you. Get that kid out of my sight.
The foreman backed away.
Not me. I don't much care for snakes.
Really? Then you're fired.
Once again, the vice president turned to confront Officer Delinco.
Make yourself useful.
Shoot the damn things.
No, sir. Not around all these people. Too dangerous.
The policeman approached the boy and dropped to one knee.
How'd you get here? He asked.
Hopped the fence last night. Then I hid under the backhoe, the boy said. You walked right past me about 5 times.
You're the one who painted my patrol car last week.
No comment.
And ran away from the hospital.
Double no comment, the boy said.
And hung your green shirt on my antenna?
Man, you don't understand. The owl's got no chance against those machines.
I do understand. I honestly do, Officer Delinco said.
One more question. You serious about the cottonmouths?
Serious as a heart attack.
Can I have a look in the bucket?
The boy's eyes flickered.
It's your funeral, he said.
Roy whispered to Beatrice.
We gotta do something quick. Those snakes aren't real.
Oh, great.
As the policeman approached the tin bucket, Beatrice shouted,
Don't do it! You might get bit!
Officer Delinco didn't flinch. He peeked over the rim for what seemed to Roy and Beatrice like an eternity.
Jigs up, Roy thought glumly. No way he won't notice they're fake.
Yet the patrolman didn't say a word as he backed away from the bucket.
Well?
Mr. Muckle demanded.
What do we do?
Kids for real. If I were you, I'd negotiate, said Officer Delinco.
Huh! I don't negotiate with juvenile delinquents.
With a snarl, Chuck Muckle snatched the gold-painted shovel from Councilman Grandy's hands and charged towards the bucket.
Don't!
Hollered the boy in the owl hole, spitting the string. But the man from Mother Paula's was unstoppable. With a wild swing of the shovel, he knocked over the bucket and commenced flailing and hacking at the snakes in a blind, slobbering fury. He didn't stop until they were in pieces. Little rubber pieces. Exhausted, Chuck Muckle leaned over and squinted at the mutilated toy snakes. His expression reflected both disbelief and humiliation.
What in the world? He wheezed.
During the violent attack on the cottonmouths, the crowd had oohed and awed. Now the only sounds to be heard were the click, click, click of the news photographers' cameras and the panting of the Mother Paula's vice president.
Hey, them snakes are fake, Curly piped. They ain't even real.
Roy leaned toward Beatrice and whispered, Another Einstein. Chuck Muckle pivoted in slow motion. Ominously, he pointed the blade of the shovel at the boy in the owl burrow.
You,
he bellowed, stalking forward. Roy jumped in front of him.
Out of my way, kid, Chuck Muckle said. I don't have time for any more of your nonsense. Move it, now.
It was clear that the Mother Paula's big shot had totally lost his cool, and possibly his marbles.
What are you doing? Roy asked, knowing he probably wouldn't get a calm, patient answer.
I said, get out of my way!
I'm gonna dig that little twerp out of the ground myself!
Beatrice Leap darted forward and stood next to Roy, taking his right hand. An anxious murmur swept through the crowd.
Aw, that's real cute! Just like Romeo and Juliet!
Chuck Muckle taunted. He dropped his voice and said,
Game over, kiddies. On the count of three, I'm gonna start using this shovel. Or better yet, how about I get Baldy over here to crank up the bulldozer?
The foreman scowled.
I thought you said I was fired.
Out of nowhere, somebody grabbed Roy's left hand. It was Garrett, his skateboard tucked under one arm. Three of his skateboarding homies were lined up beside him.
What are you guys doing? Roy said.
Skipping school, Garrett replied merrily.
But dude, this looks like way more fun.
Roy turned to see that Beatrice had been joined by the entire soccer team, linking arms in a silent chain. They were tall, strong girls who weren't the least bit intimidated by Chuck Muckle's blustery threats. Chuck Muckle realized it, too.
Stop this foolishness right now, he begged. There's no need for an ugly mob scene.
Roy watched in wonderment as more and more kids slipped out of the crowd and began joining hands, forming a human barricade around Beatrice's self-buried stepbrother. None of the parents made a move to stop them. The TV cameraman announced that the demonstration was being broadcast live on the noon news, while the photographer from the paper swooped in for a close-up of Mr. Muckle, looking drained, defeated, and suddenly very old. He braced himself on the ceremonial shovel as if it were a cane.
Didn't any of you people hear me?
He rasped.
This event is over! Done! You can all go home now!
The mayor, Councilman Grandy, and the man from the Chamber of Commerce stealthily retreated to their limousine, while Leroy Brannett plodded off to his trailer in search of a cold beer. Officer Delenko leaned against the fence, writing up a report. Roy was in an eerie, yet tranquil days. Some girl started singing a famous old folk song called This Land Is Your Land. It was Beatrice of all people, and her voice was surprisingly lovely and soft. Before long, the other kids were singing along too. Roy shut his eyes and felt like he was floating on the sunny slope of a cloud.
Excuse me, Hotshot. Got room for one more?
Roy blinked open his eyes and broke into a grin.
Yes, ma'am, he said.
Mother Paula stepped between him and Garrett to join the circle. Her voice was gravelly, but she could carry a tune just fine. The demonstration went on for another hour. Two other TV crews showed up, along with a couple of extra Coconut Cove police cruisers summoned by Officer Delenko. Chuck Muckle exhorted the newly arrived lawmen to arrest the protesters for trespassing, truancy, and disturbing the peace. The suggestion was firmly rejected, a sergeant informing Mr. Muckle that handcuffing a bunch of middle school kids wouldn't be good for the public safety department's image. The situation remained fairly stable until the flamboyant arrival of Lana Leap, who'd spotted her son on the TV news. She was all dressed up like she'd been invited to a party, and she wasn't the least bit shy about sticking her nose in front of the cameras. Roy overheard her tell a reporter how proud she was of her boy, risking his freedom to save the poor, helpless owls.
"He's my brave little champion,"
Lana crowed obnoxiously. With a phony squeal of affection, she charged toward the wall of humanity that encircled her son. Beatrice ordered everyone to lock arms, blocking Lana's path. There was one hairy moment when Lana and her stepdaughter stood glowering at each other, eye to eye, as if they were about to tangle. Garrett broke the standoff with a phenomenal fake fart that sent Lana reeling backward in horror. Roy nudged Beatrice.
Look up there.
Overhead, a small, dusky-colored bird was flying in marvelous, daring corkscrews. Roy and Beatrice watched in delight as it banked lower and lower, finishing with a radical dive toward the burrow at the center of the circle. Everybody whirled to see where the bird had landed. All of a sudden, the singing stopped. There was Mullet Fingers, trying not to giggle, the daredevil owl perched calmly on the crown of his head.
Don't worry, little guy, the boy said. You're safe for now.
21. Napoleon.
Napoleon Bridger? Roy read the name aloud. It's certainly colorful, his mother remarked. They were at the breakfast table. Mrs. Eberhardt carefully clipped articles and photographs from the morning newspaper. The front page featured a picture of Roy, Beatrice, and Mother Paula clasping hands in the circle at the demonstration. The head of Beatrice's stepbrother could be seen in the background, looking very much like a fallen coconut with a blonde toupee. The caption beneath the photograph revealed Mother Paula as an actress and former beauty queen named Kimberly Lou Dixon. Beatrice's stepbrother was identified as Napoleon Bridger Leap.
Is he back home now? Roy's mother asked.
I don't know if he'd call it that, Roy said, but he's back with his mom and stepfather. At the scene of the student protest, Lana Leap had pitched a weepy, spluttering fit and demanded to be reunited with her son. Not knowing any better, police officers had led her out of the crowd toward Mullet Fingers, spooking the bold little owl away from the boy.
My champ! My brave little hero!
Lana had swooned for the cameras as he wriggled out of the burrow. Roy and Beatrice had watched in helpless disgust as she'd locked Mullet Fingers in a smothering, melodramatic hug. Mrs. Eberhardt clipped out the newspaper photo of Lana posing with the boy, who looked extremely uncomfortable.
Maybe things will be better between the two of them, Roy's mother said hopefully.
No, Mom, she just wanted to be on TV. Roy reached for his backpack. I better get going.
Your father wants to see you before school.
Oh. Mr. Eberhardt had worked late the previous night, and Roy had already gone to sleep by the time he'd gotten home.
Is he mad? Roy asked his mother.
I don't think so. Mad about what?
Roy pointed at the paper, checkerboarded with scissor holes.
About what happened yesterday. About what me and Beatrice did.
Honey, you didn't break any laws. You didn't hurt anybody, Mrs. Eberhardt said. All you did was speak out for what you believed was right. Your dad respects that.
Roy knew that respects wasn't necessarily the same thing as agrees with. He had a feeling his father was sympathetic on the owl issue, but Mr. Eberhardt had never come out and said so.
Mom, is Mother Paula still going to build the pancake house?
I don't know, Roy. Apparently this muckle fellow lost his temper and tried to strangle a reporter when she asked the same question.
No way.
Roy and Beatrice had left before the impromptu press conference was over. Mrs. Eberhardt held up the clipping.
Says so right here.
Roy couldn't believe how much space the newspaper had devoted to the owl protest. It must have been the biggest story to hit Coconut Cove since the last hurricane. His mother said,
The phone started ringing at 6 this morning. Your dad made me take it off the hook.
I'm really sorry, Mom.
Don't be silly. I'm making a whole scrapbook, honey. Something to show your children and grandchildren.
I'd rather show them the owls, Roy thought, if there are any left by then.
Roy?
It was his father, calling to him from the den.
Could you please get the door?
A thin young woman with short-cropped black hair greeted Roy on the front steps. She was armed with a spiral notebook and a ballpoint pen.
Hi, I'm from the Gazette, she announced.
Thanks, but we've already got a subscription. The woman laughed.
Oh, I don't sell the newspaper. I write it.
She extended a hand.
Kelly Colfax.
On her neck, Roy noticed several bluish finger-sized marks that resembled the bruises that Dana Matherson had left on him. Roy figured that Kelly Colfax was the reporter whom Chuck Muckle had tried to choke.
I'll go get my father, he said.
Oh, that's not necessary. It's you I wanted to speak with, she said. You are Roy Eberhardt, right? Roy felt trapped. He didn't want to act rude, but he certainly didn't want to say anything that might cause more trouble for Mullet Fingers. Kelly Colfax began firing questions.
How did you get involved in the demonstration? Are you friends with Napoleon Bridger Leap? Were you two involved in the vandalism incidents on the Mother Paula's property? Do you like pancakes? What kind of pancakes?
Roy's head was whirling. Finally, he broke in and said,
Look, I just went there to stand up for the owls. That's all.
As the reporter jotted down Roy's words, the door swung open, and there stood Mr. Eberhardt, shaved, showered, and neatly dressed in one of his gray suits.
Excuse me, ma'am. May I have a word with my son?
Absolutely, said Kelly Colfax.
Mr. Eberhardt brought Roy inside and closed the door.
Roy,
You don't have to answer any of her questions. But I just want her to know. Here, give her this.
Roy's father clicked open his briefcase and removed a thick manila folder.
What is it, Dad?
She'll figure it out. Roy opened the folder and broke into a grin.
This is the file from City Hall, isn't it?
A copy, said his father. That's correct.
The one with all Mother Paula's stuff. I tried to find it, but it wasn't there, Roy said. Now I know why.
Mr. Eberhardt explained that he had borrowed the file, Xeroxed every page, and then taken the material to some lawyers who were experts on environmental matters.
So does Mother Paula's have permission to bury the owl dens or not? Roy asked. Was it in the file?
His father shook his head.
Nope.
Roy was exultant, but also puzzled.
Dad, shouldn't you be giving this to somebody at the Justice Department? Why do you want me to hand it over to the newspaper?
Because there's something there that everybody in Coconut Cove ought to know. Mr. Eberhardt spoke in a hushed and confidential tone. Actually, it's what isn't there that's important.
Tell me, Roy said.
And his father did. When Roy opened the front door again, Kelly Colfax was waiting with a perky smile.
Can we continue our interview?
Roy smiled brightly in return.
Sorry, but I'm running real late for school.
He held out the file.
Here, this might help with your story.
The reporter tucked her notebook under one arm and snatched the folder from Roy's hands. As she thumbed through the documents, the elation on her face dissolved into frustration.
What does all this stuff mean, Roy? What exactly am I looking for?
I think it's called an EIS, Roy said, reciting what his father had told him,
which stands for
Environmental Impact Statement.
Right, of course, the reporter said. Every big construction project is supposed to do one. That's the law.
Yeah, but Mother Paula's EIS isn't in there.
You're losing me, Roy.
It's supposed to be in that file, he said, but it's not. That means the company never did one, or they lost it on purpose.
Ah!
Kelly Colfax looked as if she'd just won the lottery.
Thank you, Roy, she said, embracing the folder with both arms as she backed down the steps. Thank you very, very much.
Don't thank me, Roy said under his breath. Thank my dad, who obviously cared about the owls, too. Epilogue. During the following weeks, the Mother Paula's story mushroomed into a full-blown scandal. The missing environmental impact statement made the front page of the Gazette and ultimately proved to be the fatal blow to the Pancake House project. It turned out that a thorough EIS had been completed and that the company's biologist had documented 3 mated pairs of burrowing owls living on the property. In Florida, the birds were strictly protected as a species of special concern, so their presence on the Mother Paula's site would have created serious legal problems and a public relations disaster if it had become widely known. Consequently, the environmental impact statement conveniently disappeared from the city files. The report later turned up in a golf bag owned by Councilman Bruce Grandy, along with an envelope containing approximately $4,500 in cash. Councilman Grandy indignantly denied that the money was a bribe from the Pancake People. Then he rushed out and hired the most expensive defense lawyer in Fort Myers. Meanwhile, Kimberly Lou Dixon quit her TV role as Mother Paula, declaring she couldn't work for a company that would bury baby owls just to sell a few flapjacks. The climax of her tearful announcement came when she displayed her life membership card from the Audubon Society, a moment captured by Entertainment Tonight, Inside Hollywood, and People magazine, which also published the picture of Kimberly Lou, Roy, and Beatrice hand in hand at the owl protest. It was more media attention than Kimberly Lou Dixon had received as the Miss America runner-up, or even as the future star of Mutant Invaders from Jupiter 7. Roy's mother kept track of the actress's soaring career in the show business columns, where it was reported that she'd signed a deal to appear in the next Adam Sandler movie. By contrast, the owl publicity was a nightmare for Mother Paula's All-American Pancake Houses, Inc., which found itself the subject of an unflattering front-page article in the Wall Street Journal. Immediately, the price of the company's stock began sinking like a stone. After going wacko at the groundbreaking ceremony, Chuck E. Muckle got demoted to the post of Assistant Junior Vice President. Although he did not go to jail for choking the newspaper reporter, he was forced to take a class called How to Manage Your Anger, which he failed. Soon afterward, he resigned from the pancake company and took a job as a cruise director in Miami. In the end, Mother Paula's had no choice but to abandon its plan to put a restaurant on the corner of East Oriole and Woodbury. There were the nagging headlines about the missing EIS, the embarrassing resignation of Kimberly Lou Dixon, the TV footage of Chuck Muckle throttling Kelly Colfax, and last but not least, those darn owls. Everybody was upset about the owls. NBC and CBS sent film crews to Trace Middle School to meet with the student protesters, as well as with faculty members. Roy lay low, but he later heard from Garrett that Miss Hennepin had given an interview in which she praised the kids who took part in the lunchtime protest and claimed she'd encourage them to participate. Roy was always amused when grown-ups lied to make themselves look more important. He wasn't watching TV that evening, but his mother burst in to report that Tom Brokaw was talking about him and Beatrice on the network news. Mrs. Eberhardt led Roy to the living room just in time to hear the president of Mother Paula's promise to preserve the Coconut Cove property as a permanent sanctuary for burrowing owls and to donate $50,000 to the Nature Conservancy. "We want to assure all our customers that Mother Paula's remains strongly committed to protecting our environment," he said, "and we deeply regret that the careless actions of a few former employees and contractors may have put these unique little birds in jeopardy." "What a crock," Roy muttered. "Roy Andrew Eberhardt." "Sorry, Mom, but the guy's not telling the truth. He knew about the owls. They all knew about the owls." Mr. Eberhardt muted the television set. "Roy's right, Lizzie. They're just covering their butts." "Well, the important thing is you did it," Roy's mother told him. "The birds are safe from the pancake people. You should feel great about that." "I do," Roy said. "But it wasn't me who saved the owls." Mr. Eberhardt came over and put a hand on his son's shoulder. "You got the word out, Roy. Without you, nobody would have known what was happening. Nobody would have showed up to protest the bulldozing." "Yeah, but it all started because of Beatrice's stepbrother," Roy said. "He's the one who should have been on Peter Brokaw or whatever. The whole thing was his idea." "I know, honey," Mrs. Eberhardt said. "But he's gone." Roy nodded. "Sure looks that way." Mullet Fingers had lasted less than 48 hours under the same roof with Lana, who'd spent most of that time on the telephone trying to drum up more TV interviews. Lana had been counting on her son to keep the Leap family in the limelight, which is the last place he wanted to be. With Beatrice's assistance, the boy had snuck out of the house while Lana and Leon were arguing about a new dress that Lana had purchased for $700 in anticipation of appearing on The Oprah Winfrey Show. Nobody from Oprah's program ever called Lana back, so Leon demanded that she return the dress and get a full refund. When the Leap's shouting reached the same approximate decibel level as a B-52, Beatrice lowered her stepbrother out a bathroom window. Unfortunately, a nosy neighbor had mistaken the escape for a burglary in progress and had notified the police. Mullet Fingers made it only two blocks before speeding patrol cars surrounded him. Lana had been furious to learn that her son was up to his old runaway tricks. Out of spite, she told the officers that he'd stolen a valuable toe ring from her jewelry box and demanded that he be locked up in juvenile detention to teach him a lesson. There the boy had lasted only 17 hours before breaking out, this time with an unlikely accomplice. Hiding in the laundry basket with his new best friend, Dana Matherson undoubtedly had no clue that he'd been specially selected to join the jailbreak, that the scrawny blonde kid knew exactly who he was and knew all the rotten things he'd done to Roy Eberhardt. Being of simple mind, Dana probably had thought only of his unexpected good fortune as the laundry basket was loaded into the laundry truck, which was then driven out the gates of the detention center. Even the approaching sirens probably hadn't worried him until the truck braked and the back doors flew open. It was then the two young fugitives leaped from the smelly bundle of dirty clothes and made a run for it. Later, when Roy heard the story from Beatrice, he knew instantly why her stepbrother had chosen Dana Matherson as an escape partner. Mullet Fingers was fleet and slippery, while Dana was sluggish and sore-footed, still not fully recovered from his encounter with the rat traps. The perfect decoy, that was Dana. Sure enough, the police had easily caught up with the big thug, though he shook off two officers before eventually being tackled and handcuffed. By then, Beatrice's stepbrother was a distant blur, a bronze-colored wisp vanishing into a snarled tree line. The police never found him, nor did they search particularly hard. Dana was the prize catch, the one with the rap sheet and the bad attitude. Roy couldn't find Mullet Fingers either. Many times he'd ridden his bicycle to the junkyard and checked the JoJo's ice cream truck, but it was always empty. Then, one day, the truck itself vanished, dragged off and pressed into a rusty cube of scrap metal. Beatrice Leap knew where her stepbrother was hiding, but he'd sworn her to secrecy. "Sorry, Tex," she told Roy. "I made a blood promise." So yes, the kid was gone. And Roy knew he'd never see Napoleon Bridger again. Unless he wanted to be seen. "He'll be all right. He's a survivor," Roy said for his mother's benefit.
"I hope you're right," she said, "but he's so young."
"Hey, I've got an idea." Roy's father jangled his car keys. "Let's go for a ride." When the Eberharts arrived at the corner of Woodbury and East Oriole, two other vehicles were already parked at the fence gate. One was a squad car, the other was a blue pickup truck. Roy recognized both of them. Officer David Delenko had stopped on his way home from the police station, where he'd received another commendation from the chief, this time for aiding in the recapture of Dana Matherson. Leroy Curly Brannett, who was temporarily between jobs, had been driving his wife and mother-in-law to the outlet mall when he decided to make the brief detour. Like the Eberharts, they'd come to see the owls. As dusk fell, they waited in a friendly and uncomplicated silence, though there was plenty they could have talked about. Except for the fence with its fading streamers, the land bore no sign that the Pancake House people had ever been there. Curly's trailer had been towed, the earth-moving machines hauled away, the Travelin' Johnnies returned to the toilet rental company. Even the survey stakes were gone, uprooted and carted off with the trash. Gradually the night air filled with the buzz of crickets, and Roy smiled to himself, remembering the box full he'd released there. Obviously, the owls had plenty of other bugs to eat. Before long, a pair of the birds popped out of a nearby burrow. They were followed by a wobbly-legged youngster that looked as fragile as a Christmas ornament. In unison, the owls rotated their onion-sized heads to stare at the humans who were staring at them. Roy could only imagine what they were thinking.
"I got to admit," Curly said with a fond grunt, "they're kind of cute."
On Saturday, after the Mother Paula scandal had died down, Roy went to watch Beatrice and her friends play a soccer game. It was a sweltering afternoon, but Roy had resigned himself to the fact that there was no change of seasons in South Florida, only mild variations of summer. And though he missed the crisp Montana autumns, Roy found himself daydreaming less often about the place. Today the sun lit up the green soccer field like a neon carpet, and Roy was happy to peel off his t-shirt and bake. Beatrice scored 3 goals before she noticed him sprawled in the bleachers. When she waved, Roy gave her 2 thumbs up and chuckled, because it was pretty funny. Beatrice the Bear waving at Tex, the new kid. The high sun and the steaming heat reminded Roy of another bright afternoon not so long ago, in a place not so far off. Before the soccer match ended, he grabbed his shirt and slipped away. It was a short ride from the soccer field to the hidden creek. Roy chained his bike to a gnarly old stump and picked his way through the tangled trees. The tide was very high,
and only a weather-beaten wedge of the Molly Bell's pilot house showed above the waterline. Roy hung his sneakers on a forked limb and swam out toward the wreck, the warm current nudging him along. With both hands, he grabbed the lip of the pilot house roof and hoisted himself up on the warped bare wood. There was scarcely enough space for a dry perch. Roy lay on his belly, blinked the salt from his eyes, and waited. The quiet wrapped around him like a soft blanket. First, he spotted the T-shaped shadow of the osprey crossing the pale green water beneath him. Later came the white heron, gliding low in futile search of a shallow edge to wade. Eventually, the bird lighted halfway up a black mangrove, squawking irritably about the high tides. The elegant company was welcome, but Roy kept his eyes fastened on the creek. The splash of a feeding tarpon upstream put him on alert, and sure enough, the surface of the water began to shake and boil. Within moments, a school of mullet erupted, sleek bars of silver shooting airborne again and again. Atop the pilot house, Roy scooted forward as far as he dared, dangling both arms. The mullet quit jumping, but assembled in a V-shaped squadron that pushed a nervous ripple down the middle of the creek toward the Molly Bell. Soon the water beneath him darkened, and Roy could make out the blunt-headed shapes of individual fish, each swimming frantically for its life. As the school approached the sunken crab boat, it divided as cleanly as if it had been sliced by a saber. Quickly, Roy picked out one fish and, teetering precariously, plunged both hands into the current. For one thrilling moment, he actually felt it in his grasp, as cool and slick and magical as mercury. He squeezed his fingers into fists, but the mullet easily jetted free, leaping once before it rejoined the fleeing school. Roy sat up and gazed at his dripping, empty palms. Impossible, he thought. Nobody could catch one of those darn things barehanded. Not even Beatrice's stepbrother. It must have been a trick, some sort of clever illusion. A noise like a laugh came out of the dense, knotted mangroves. Roy assumed it was the heron, but when he looked up, he saw that the bird had gone. Slowly he rose, shielding his brow from the sun's glare.
"That you?" he shouted. "Napoleon Bridger? Is that you?"
Nothing. Roy waited and waited until the sun dropped low and the creek was draped in shadows. No more laughing sounds came from the trees. Reluctantly, he slid off the Molly Bell and let the falling tide carry him to shore. Robotically, he got into his clothes, though when he reached for his shoes, he saw that only one was hanging from the forked bough. His right sneaker was missing. Roy put on the left sneaker and went hopping in search of the other. He soon found it half submerged in the shallows beneath the branches, where he figured it must have fallen. Yet when he bent to pick up the shoe, it wouldn't come loose. The laces had been securely entwined around a barnacle-encrusted root. Roy's fingers trembled as he undid the precisely tied, clove-hitched knots. He lifted the soggy sneaker and peeked inside. There he spied a mullet, no larger than a man's index finger, flipping and splashing to protest its captivity. Roy emptied the baby fish into his hand and waded deeper into the creek. Gently he placed the mullet in the water, where it flashed once and vanished like a spark. Roy stood motionless, listening intently, but all he heard was the hum of the mosquitoes and the low whisper of the tide. The running boy was already gone. As Roy laced on his other sneaker, he laughed to himself. So the great bare-handed mullet grab wasn't a trick. It wasn't impossible after all. "Guess I'll have to come back another day and try again," Roy thought. That's what a real Florida boy would do. This is Chad Lowe. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Hoot by Carl Hiaasen. This program was produced and directed by John Wager. Executive producer, Sherry Huber. Text copyright 2002 by Carl Hiaasen.
Production copyright 2002, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.